You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, welcome to the Orthodox Nationalist. As always, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is being recorded on the 20th of July, 2024. I want to mention one person in particular, a donor, who deserves special mention. Of course, I don't mention names, but, and you know, he's an important donor, but even anyone who's donated money, I don't think you have an idea, but just how powerful that is to me. What an impact that makes on me. That you have that level of faith that you're willing to sacrifice what amounts to your labor to keep me on the air, to keep me independent. And the independence factor is huge. I don't have to answer to anyone. And that puts me, regardless of the academic world or anything else, that puts me in a position that is absolutely enviable. And it's because of you guys and one person in particular. So I appreciate all of you. Today, we're going to do something that, when I discovered this, it fascinated me from then on. It's the concept of Sobornost or Sobornopravna. Whether it be the Russian and the Ukrainian versions, respectively, as a ontological or metaphysical foundation for the church. Now, these are associated in the 19th century with the Slavophiles. Now, I've dealt with the Slavophiles elsewhere. So we can't get into that again here. But it's just a more modern conception of a much more ancient concept. The terms are thrown around all the time, especially subordinates. And it's very rare that you find outside of Komiakov and Kadivsky a solid understanding. Sometimes people talk about the results of these things. But this is a state of affairs. The syllable Nost tends to refer to a state, not state as in government, but a state of affairs, a situation. And I was fascinated by this, and was very disappointed to find very little on it. And so I set about doing everything I can to lay out a formalization of it. What I realized was that this is the very foundation of the Orthodox Church. So Sobornost is what poetry is to prose, what the spirit of the law is to the letter. But that has to be grounded. I mean, these are nice metaphors. But what is it to have the spirit versus the letter of the law? What is the spirit we're talking about? And it resists conceptualization, at least strictly speaking. You come across either Ukrainian or Russian Orthodoxy, these terms will arise. It is the political social theology of the Orthodox Church. And I've argued that it derives its substance from the Old Testament. And I'm known for this kind of thing, especially Sobornopravna. These are mentalities rather than a set of ideas. They are the foundation of church life or social or economic organization. I've often decried the rejection or the total ignorance of the Old Testament from Christian people, with an exception occasionally of Genesis and the Psalms. But the prophetic element, prophets are the spirit of the law, something that after Christ's resurrection, the Talmud completely rejected. And without logos, they created their own self-deification. But the Old Testament is absolutely essential to understand anything that Jesus Christ or the apostles stated. After all, Christ not only spoke like the prophets, he cited them constantly. Now, of course, Christ didn't come to lay out a political or economic vision, and you're going to be very disappointed if you think you're going to find it in the New Testament. And that's because, as I've said many times, because Christ assumed that his hearers were already knowledgeable about the Old Testament, including the prophets. And they did lay out a basic set of principles, although mostly in the spiritual rather than the legal realm. The prophets are included in the canon of Scripture as well as the law books. And that is no accident. And in fact, Christ cannot be understood outside of this tradition. And what I've done over the last, 15 years, my first paper in this came out in 2008. And what laying this out relative to neo-medievalism, royalism, to counter the slogans of the those who believe in the rule of law, quote unquote, modernity, as a in terms of political thought, is a void. Political theory in the academy simply is foundational power. Of course, as always, corporate NGOs and BlackRock decides what's legitimate debate and what isn't, what's a legitimate point of view and what is not. But this level of dogma and censorship is normal for academia. And of course, like everything else in modern life, it's a lie. Or more specifically, it's a manipulative image. I've been over that so many times, I'm not going to get into it again, but they masquerade as reality. Images cloak those who actually make these socially important decisions. Now, we all know that the Western world, dominated by BlackRock, who controls the economy to a great extent, is breathing its last breath. Debt, unrepayable, mental illness, low birth rate, invaders from the third world. And it's my opinion that nationalists, especially Orthodox nationalists, have to be prepared, not just physically, but also with a coherent theory and understanding of communal liberty. Not to mention the sacerdotal monarchy. Something to replace this democratic oligarchy, which is, in fact, American politics. We're talking about the foundation of the Orthodox agrarian and ethnic tradition. And to me, these are three sides of the same triangle, and that this is how society can be regenerated, if in fact that's even an option at this point. The spirit of the law, the letter of the law. The letter of the law may refer to the state or the administration. Words, syntax, and their formalized meaning on paper. Spirit of the law is very different. It does away with administration. Sometimes administration or bureaucracy goes beyond local custom and it strangles it. It's a Procrustean bed. And the more modernist, the more liberal, the more violence has to be used, the more centralization is required. Subordinates is the very opposite of this. Now, there's a phrase called national anarchy. It's not something I'm going to advocate. That I interpreted German nationalists like Johann Herder, Ukrainians like Nikola Kostomarov, because all of these are related to Sobornost. It's an ethno-religious particularity, a tradition, a way of life, but with respect only to its inner principle, its content, not the administration or the external coding, the realm of money and power. It's the noumenon as opposed to the phenomenon. I've also made the point that in ancient Israel, it is in the tribal organization of Shechem, the centralized shrines, which will then be abolished under the rule of the temple later. And then that temple became paganized under Solomon. Now, whether I search for in Russian, Ukrainian, or in English, Sobornopravna, Sobornost, you don't find a lot of solid definitions or understanding. But it certainly doesn't mean different things to different people. That's the opposite of meaning. Now this goes back to 2006 from the Kievan Patriarchate. Now this is, you know, the anti-Russian version of this. And a writer on their web journal online says the following, a guy by the name of Lesyuk. Sobornopravnist is a popular control of church affairs. It's the foundation of not only Ukrainian, but in general the whole apostolic church. Sobornopravnist represents, one, the right of elected clergy, or elective clergy, two, the right of the superintendents over church property, and three, the right, the church population we're talking about here, to participate in all matters of church life, charitable, economic, educational, liturgical, and even dogmatic. According to this, the bishops have lost their leading role in the church. Ecclesiastical authority was transferred to the hands of elected councils at the national, metropolitan, township, and even the parish level. Now, for a whole lot of reasons, that's a terrible definition. And I think you may have noticed that the key to this is in the canonical and even dogmatic alleged democratic control that this concept lays out. It does no such thing. They're talking about the people, which is very vague and very abstract. You should also always be suspicious of those kind of terms. That bishops, and hence monks, have no role here. Now, some of this stuff may be a result of Sobornopravnost. But leaving out the spiritual and metaphysical elements, it's nonsense. It's reducing something spiritual into something administrative. And if you define it the way this man did, then it's pure rhetoric. To say that the church people can participate, whatever that means, in all areas of church life, including the dogmatic. But it is far more useful to see the concept within the local. When local authority, regional authority, ethnic authority was overthrown in favor of centralization, the local tradition was lost, which means that the people of Israel, that's the Orthodox Church today, become pawns in the power politics of the era. Many, many years ago, I got involved in the Western Rite of the Orthodox Church, because these were the much older ethnic liturgies that the centralization of the Roman papacy destroyed, claiming during the Renaissance there was only one Latin rite that came out of the Council of Trent. Solomon's Israel took the administration, including of the temple as well as the country, away from the tradition. Because of Israel's involvement with the pagan monetized economy, the economy of Tyre, which itself is a descendant of Nimrod, the Babylonian materialist idea, and Solomon fell into heresy, which he was warned about many times, and he died in a state of heresy, which is why I never quite understood why he is depicted with a halo. I have never received a firm answer to that. He died as a heretic. He died worshiping pagan gods within the temple itself. So modernism, the opposite of what we're talking about here, it's a top-down. You think of the Moscow Patriarchate in the 1940s and 1950s. It was a top-down organization rather than an organism. That's another phrase used all the time without much of a definition. So things like grace and law are constructs of this bureaucracy, and then it's dispensed to all of us. But this is the very opposite of the Orthodox tradition, especially in its ethnic guise, whether Eastern or Western. Modernism has an obsession with bureaucracy and centralized control. This is the nature of enlightened absolutism. And, of course, requires nominalism to function. Subona pravna, subornost are never nominalist doctrines whatsoever. So when the individual alone is assumed to exist, there is no community. It's just a collective. I want to quote Alexander Dugin, because in his political philosophy, I translated this myself a long time ago, and let me quote it because it may clarify some of this. If in the Western Middle Ages was dominated by the approach of realism, that is, Thomism, then the transition to modern times in the era of the Protestant Reformation has become increasingly dominated by nominalism. It is the idea of the new man. Nominalism best describes the spirit of modernity. Recall that nominalism is based on the conviction that there are no sacred realities. It rests on the assumption that all that exists is a world of material things, and the human mind constructs ideas and concepts on the basis solely of observation. For the more efficient means of manipulating nature, rationalism began to abstract, giving names to things that are arbitrary vocal equivalents. The sacred intuition of being in the world, the penetration into its sacred dimension and the experience of the divine presence, is discarded as the empiricists falsify the picture of the observed world. The empirical nominalist approach created a radical desacralization of the world. Western man has lost its cults and rituals, traditions and myths, ancient covenants and traditions, spiritual experience and religious contemplation, intuition, and its taste of the sacred. This is the essence of tradition, regardless of the society. Empiricism undermines the deep roots of what has been defined as the primal, traditional idea. Now, if his political philosophy has been translated into English, I'm not aware of it. That's from page 212, 213. The possibility for actual community. I'm not talking about collectives. I'm talking about community, the sobor. In the empirical nominalist world, that can't be done. If that's the dominant intellectual point of view, then grace doesn't make any sense, because there's no place for it in the world. Ultimately, nominalism says all meaning is arbitrary, all ideas above the individual thing, all ideas are artificial. Words are separated from objects. So that means if language mediates thought and words give reality to things, that means that whomever controls language controls existence, or the very notion of what is real. Church and state both are meant to be governed by the local sobor, in the broadest sense of that world. The way of life manifests in the local parish, the skeet, or the brotherhood within a regional ethnic context. This is how doctrine is put in motion, the daily lives of people. The extended family, the parish family, the local monastery, each essentially checking one another. Without the local hermitage or the skeet in a diocese, the perennial aspect of Orthodoxy in Europe, the parish ends up being like a mechanical or perfunctory set of rites, apart from the understanding of people. It's the life of the parish, local tradition, the ethno-communal imperative. This is what we're talking about by Subona Pravna. That's at the basis of law, justice, and any just future world order. Now, I mentioned national anarchism, which always interested me. The left, the rare times it even mentions it, has no idea what's being said here. We're not talking about the state. State defined as a formal set of bureaucracies, interlocking administrations. It's anarchistic in the sense that it rejects a central administration and defines justice as congruent with local Christian custom, which of course would be the very last thing some collegiate upper middle class anarchist would ever say. It's reactionary in the sense that it's based on the traditional life of the village, the monastery, the parish, family. This is the fight against civilization, defined here as the opposite of culture, like the way Spengler defined it. Civilization is itself deified in the person of Janus, the two-headed god of settled life, depicted as bringing the benighted herd into elite high-tech civilization with social science, control, and regimentation of all aspects of life. Now, anarchy, in an atavistic kind of a way, maintains authority, just not centralized structures of rule. It's authority rather than power. The concept of the bishop, as I've said many times before, has fallen, not just in terms of behavior, but in terms of its very concept. There is only the relation of a bishop, which is, by the way, an office, not an individual, to the congregation, to the monastery, not to distant patriarchs or synods that no one ever meets. In the narrow sense, when a synod begins to believe themselves to be above local custom and the very font itself of truth and justice, you have a problem. The relation of bishop to parish or monastery is a mystical one. Now, what do I mean by this? All of these terms are so wispy that they're easy to dismiss. The bishop is a spokesman for the diocesan synod. He speaks in the plural. It's a structure. It's a hierarchy based not on power, but on prayer and struggle. The hierarchy, as you know, the quotation at the very beginning here, the hierarchy exists only relatively. Now, of course, today, the bishop is not a teacher. He's not a defender of the faith. In fact, they can be the worst bought purveyors of heresy anywhere. Now, this is the foundation of Sobora Pravda. It's a decentralized group of dioceses and monasteries, largely self-governing and dependent on the ancient tradition of the church as its constitution. This has nothing to do with representation or democratic rule over dogma, whatever that idiot said. It's the concept of freedom, freedom from internal passions. And this goes for institutions as well as anything else. Passions like lust or greed that enslave the individual, enslave the soul no differently than any other external administration. Those passions can pervert the relations between the abbot and the monk, pastor to parishioner, bishop to priest. It becomes a matter of alienation and control. The institution becomes a foreign oppressor. The opposite of that, Subhana Pravda, the spirit of the law. That's the idea of authority rather than power. This is the development of the inner freedom absolutely necessary for rational life. The old believers maintained it. The so-called non-possessors maintained it. The skeet life maintained it. Those of us who believe a monarchy that's sacerdotal, not administrative. And in Russia, as you know, this was all vitiated by Peter the Great. I have also noted that the monastic structure of early medieval Ireland has a fairly advanced conception of this, prior to the Norman invasion, I mean. The Athenite hesychasts, or the Irish Kuldees, are similar in that sense. What's the distinction between the large monastery and the small skeet? That's the difference between administration, the letter of the law, and the spirit of the law. In a small skeet, you don't really have a rule, or when you talk about a rule, you read one, it's really an essay on struggle. It's not a numbered list of things. And the tradition usually is local, based on the saints who had gone before in this very same area. But when you think of anarchy, in its true sense, not in the sense of chaos, but in the modern world, it's inherently a leftist phenomenon, but that means it's a fraud. It's just an outlet and justification for individual passions. and they're productive of nothing. And they are as authoritarian. They want to shut down anyone who disagrees with them, which is very odd. But when you attach the word national or ethno to it, now you're talking about something very different. The ethnos, local tradition. That's the only place really where representation makes any sense. The doctrine that we accept comes from a collective tradition of the Orthodox people. And those localities are brought together in the ecumenical synods. If it didn't agree with the local sobor, it was not accepted as authoritative. And it wasn't so much what bishops voted on or anything like that, but what was the tradition that's felt and intuited rather than laid out in prose. I said in the beginning that what we're talking about here, the difference between poetry and prose. Because a constitution only uses words, and these words have definitions that change quite a bit over time. In and of itself, it's a useless piece of paper. It has to be understood. The definitions we give some of these terms are not just different from what they were in the late 18th century, but the complete opposite of what they were. So, sobornos is manifest in the local parish, the ethnic tradition, the skeet, the hermitage. That's the basis of the Orthodox tradition. It's only when the state and church become centralized, so the Israelites under Solomon, Russia under Peter, Ireland under the later Normans, that's where you have heresy and administration. That's the doorway, the wedge, the thin end of the wedge where it can invade the church, and then the rites become sterile and perfunctory. And this is all over the prophets of the Old Testament. The church becomes a department of the state or the economy, a pleasant set of rituals that connect the individual in some sentimental way. From Nimrod, or the Nimrodian mentality of the ancient world, is at the origin of the idea of civilization and enlightenment. And of course, I'm also talking about the hesychastic tradition that's also based on the local. You don't have formal ties binding them together, but by tradition, methods of prayer, interior silence. Being a member of the right synod doesn't make sense. That doesn't do anything. It comes down to the state and the economy as necessary evils, at best, but at worst, they're objects that are distracting from the love of the Trinity and the mystic life. The mystical life, by its very structure, doesn't require the formal power of the state or anything else. It's based on grace through prayer and struggle. I'm going to quote the Archimandrite Gregorius of Athos. He said this, my publication is from 2012. The roots of Neptic life and of Hezekiah in accordance with God are found in the Old Testament. The prophet Moses received experience and knowledge of God on Mount Horeb. When faced by the strange sight of the blazing bush which did not burn, he was initiated into rejecting every worldly belief reflected in the removal of his sandals, and to contemplate in reflection and riddle the mystery of the divine incarnation. The holy apostles worked exclusively in the world, in the midst of distractions, noise, and danger, but deep inside they remained hesychasts and workers of nepsis and prayer. Their apostolic work was not a social reform program, but the rebirth of souls through Christ. Now I want to quote St. Gregory of Palamas, actually from the same book, the Archimandrite I quoted above. And here's what St. Gregory has to say. It is for this reason, then, that the lover of perfect communion with God avoids the technologically assisted life and chooses the monastic and unstructured state, and he eagerly offers himself to the sanctuary of stillness without the obligations or worries of life, relieved from all other worldly relationships. Thus, having released his soul from every material bond to the extent that this is attainable, he attaches his noose to the unceasing prayer to God. And having through it concentrated the noose entirely into itself, himself, he finds a new and secret ascent to the heavens, the intangible obscurity of the apocryphal stillness, as one would say. And having precisely concentrated his noose into himself, with secret bliss in a state of utterly simple but perfect and sweet tranquility, and in genuine silence and speechlessness, he flies above all creation. And thus having been removed from himself and become entirely God's, he sees the glory of God and contemplates divine light. By nous, of course, we're talking about the deeper structures of reason. We're not talking about logic here. We're talking about natural law, the structure of reality, which, of course, our own brains replicate just like anything else. St. Basil's rule, also quoted from the same book, he talks about the community of life with the attribute of ownership is non-individual, removing every turbulence or quarrel. Everything is owed in common. God is in common. Reverence, salvation in common. Sufferings are in common. And so are the rewards. That's the basic of Orthodox life. It's the mystic contemplation of God. And regardless of where we are, we're required to take on the discipline of monastics. So for Subordinates, Bonapravna, the church, its teachings, traditions, manifest in daily life. That's the foundation of law and grace. The state provides this artificial guardrail. The state is meant to protect the ethnic and religious tradition of a people. The Orthodox are loyal to the tradition, the church, the Slavic, Greek, Western medieval tradition, embodying the life of the saint. Now let me quote Antony Kropovitsky, the great metropolitan. This separation of person and nature in us is not something incomprehensible and abstract, but a truth which is directly affirmed by self-observation and experience. Recognizing an independent personality and freedom of will and action in oneself, each person clearly understands that this independence, this freedom, consists solely in the directing of the energies and properties of the nature shared by all men, each in its own area of specialization, in the development of certain innate inclinations, and the destruction of others while choosing between conflicting inclinations. Separation of person and nature, or existence and essence. When he says nature, that's synonymous with essence or form. So you understand nature in two ways. Number one, that which is common, and, you know, a concept, love, all those acts that are loving. But the other concept of nature is that which brings a specific thing to its final purpose. So human nature itself, which Kropovitsky mentions, shared by Christ, sits on the right hand of the Father. The church is this unified entity, a single nature that contains many specializations, an aspect of the Trinity, in a way. Grace, I use the word like grace, it's light, the presence of God on earth, his energy. It's logos, manifests his energy, and all truth partakes in it. That's its foundation. Anything real is true. Thus, any created thing partakes in grace. Grace isn't separate from the rest of reality. If reality is truth, then reality is also spirit, based on the Platonic forms and logos. The truth is proper perception and understanding corresponding to what is real, while energy is the means to get from one state to another relative to it. The key factor is that it really can't be satisfactorily written down in words, unless it be understood that these words are highly metaphorical. Why didn't Christ describe heaven? It's for this very reason. Men can't express such things. Our language can't express them because they're aspects of the divine realm. We have no access to that right now, so the church uses symbols instead to begin the process of ascent. That's what the sacraments, the liturgies are. It's not magic. It's a physical manifestation of what already exists, God's presence, his grace. Vladimir Lossky, and I've quoted him, this particular one, many times. For the Eastern tradition, the created supernatural has no existence. That which Western theology calls by the name supernatural signifies for the East the uncreated, the divine energies ineffably distinct from the essence of God. The difference consists in the fact that the Western conception of grace implies the idea of causality, grace being represented as an effect of the divine cause, exactly as in the act of creation. While for Orthodox theology, There is a natural procession, the energy shining forth eternally from the divine essence. It is in the creation alone that God acts as cause in producing a new subject called to participate in the divine fullness, preserving it, saving it, granting grace to it, and guiding it towards its final goal. In his energies, he is, he exists, he eternally manifests himself. Grace, in fact, is logos, the energy of logos, manifest on earth. Created grace cannot be it's an act of decision. It isn't. We must believe, and if we accept that idea, that grace is a created thing, and sacraments are magic tricks that only the initiated can perform. Nominalist idea argues that the ritual action is grace, and vice versa. In other words, the meaning of the word is totally exhausted by its symbol. God is totally sovereign. What God says is good only because he says it, not because there's any structure of good out there that we have any access to. I've also made the argument that the rise of the nominalist idea, even in the church, causes heresies. It's responsible for the name worship controversy as a reaction to that a century ago. The old believers, too. Grace flows naturally from God as part of his very identity. In the West, it's something added to an autonomous created world. That means that the hierarchy, acting in God's stead, can direct grace to whom they will. That's the concept of sacraments as magic spells. The concept of the bishop is, and of course, Subona Pravna, Subornost are essentially about this. You see something like the Moscow Patriarchate founded in 1943, 1944, zero popular participation. But it's isolated the powers of the bishop as just a matter of bureaucratic administration. Bishops, and I'm quoting from them here, they have the supreme authority of oversight over the diocesan institutions and monasteries in his diocese. That the bishops would exercise control over the religious, administrative, and financial activities of parishes, monasteries, etc. Now, of course, these are very general powers that could cover anything. The true conception is the simple monitoring of the life of the clergy, purity, to provide them with assistance, warnings, and impose penance if necessary, temporary removal, etc. The Patriarchate of Moscow in 1944 was a purely top-down body. Its opposite was the catacomb church. The old believers, the old Rite Church of Rogoskoye in Moscow, they don't have specifically delineated powers for bishops. After all, it's been the well-attended and well-financed synods of Orthodox bishops in the past that accepted Arianism, Monophysitism, Roman Catholicism, whatever, Darwinism with great enthusiasm. Those fighting them were accused of rejecting the church's authority and they were condemned for disobedience. But the greatest of saints fought these synods tooth and nail. That means the synod is a relative authority. Loyalty to them is conditional, based entirely on doctrine alone. Subordinost, Subona Pravna, bishops don't rule. Canons aren't laws in the sense, the way that we use the word law. Usually the spiritual life has no relation to the bishop at all. The church requires a structure, but that's a necessary evil. It exists only because we're very weak and sinful people. We need threats to perform even the most minimum of Christian duties. To have priests do their job, to organize finances, that's pretty much what the externalized law is for. This is not an educational institution, because really anyone can teach the truth. It's to maintain, in this case, an absolute minimum of Christian life. Now, I've connected the opposite of Subornost, Subona Pravna. We've talked about Solomon versus the prophets in the Old Testament. But you see this in countries, too. I've stated that the version of this was Peter the Great in Russia. His mission was an arcane experiment. He was at war with Orthodoxy. It was to bring the monastic tradition under the control of Janus, the initiator, into civilization and social management. Now, I've gone on and on about Peter's crimes against the church. It was a criminal system. It's not merely that he abolished the patriarchate, that he altered the calendar. But those things by themselves show this totalitarian agenda. Janus is manifest in Peter. He becomes Lord of heaven and earth. In 1691, one of the greatest Orthodox apologists in Russia in his day, Father Sylvester Medvedev, was executed because he had been confessor to Sophia, Peter's half-sister and one-time rival for power. The abbot Abraham was tortured and murdered by people by Peter's agents in 1697 because he had written something criticizing Peter's lack of respect for human life. Peter forced bishops to swear that he, not Christ, was their ultimate judge. The monastic population declined from 25,000 at the time he took over in the late 17th century, 1691, etc. It was reduced to 14,000 by 1738. The metropolitan so-called Theophan Prokopovich saw to it right away that six bishops were tortured for criticizing Peter's abolition of the patriarchate, among other things. This is what we mean by enlightened absolutism, the opposite of Svetlana Pravda. Under Peter, thousands were killed on forced labor projects, usually in the creation of Petrograd. The city was meant to be a monument to him. Peter, conquering nature, was literally built on thousands of Cossack bodies who were frozen to death, many of whom, by the way, were old believers. But what is Peter? What is the city name of Petrograd, or St. Petersburg, the city of Peter? It's a generic name for all the gods of pagan antiquity. Peter didn't name his city in some sort of egocentric circumstance. It was a message. Pater, or Peter, was a generic name for the chief god of any given city. Peter as the city god, or the local god. Peter referred to the chief god of the city. So the chief god of the Romans was Jupiter, or Jupiter, or Zeus Peter, the chief and father of the gods in the city. The city itself being a microcosm of the Promethean drive to conquer nature in the name of the human will, which really means the will of the elite who have the wherewithal to impose their views on society at large. So Petrograd has an arcane meaning. The Temple of Apollo, for example, in Turkey is called the Patara. The oracle of Apollo there is referred to as Pateraus, clearly connected to Peter. Apollo is a god of science and enlightenment, which provides much light on the purpose of the city and its true meaning here. Peter was bringing civilization, like Prometheus, to old Russia. And it goes back that far. Paganism can be traced to Nimrod, or the hunter. Peter is a name for the phallic god you first mentioned in Mesopotamia. And even in the book of Exodus, Balaam, the chief of the pagans, is referred to as the Pethor of Mesopotamia in Deuteronomy. He sits on the chair of Nimrod as a successor. That's what Pethor refers to. Balaam and Nimrod actually are the same name. They mean conqueror of a people. Nikolaos in Greek is that version. The Peter is the ecclesiastical center of Balaam, the house of the stone phallic pillar on the Euphrates. The article Simon Peter versus Simon Magnus deserves to be read. It was Ernst Martin. So Petrograd, or Peter's Peter on the Neva, what that comes down to, social control, regimentation, rationalization. Nimrod was said to have brought reason and proper government to his people right after the floodwaters had abated. Alexander Pushkin says the same in his Bronze Horseman, one of my favorite works of Russian literature. But civilization, in the sense that Spengler uses it, as precisely prose versus poetry. Apollo is a hunter. It's an example of the same phenomenon. Civilization comes crashing into a formerly free, communal, mobile, and God-fearing people. Hugh Nibley, in his article, The Hierocentric State, he says, "This is the old story of Nimrod, who revolted against God and became the hunter of men, who founded that abominable state from which all kings of the earth take their power. Even Apollo was in the beginning a deadly hunter who came from the steppes of Asia and slew the great serpent that guarded the holy spring of Delphi, so that he could gain control of the spot to which all Greeks brought their tribute and thereby become their ruler." Janus, I've already mentioned, it's the same mentality. Prometheus, Tammuz, Nimrod, Apollo, these are gods of civilization and enlightenment. Technology will create a deified humanity, triumphant over material nature. And you see this in both Marxism and capitalism identically. Janus, according to Plutarch, was the first to bring civilization to Earth after the flood. He was the foundation of cities, the so-called life of reason, being brought to, quote, savage humanity. Pator was his name after his death. This is he was the father of the Babylonian banking system, the rule of money and usury. Janus also has control over the calendar. Peter changed the calendar later from the ancient calculation of the age of the earth to one based on the birth of Christ. According to Ovid, Janus Pastor held the keys to heaven and earth and was a lord over both, just as Peter sought to secularize the church, making himself lord of the sacraments as well as politics. He was the keeper of the keys into that pagan promised land of an automated and rationalized society. Centralization, from Nimrod to Xerxes to Solomon to Peter, there are many others. Whether it be an initiated crowned head or the techno elite in modern America, it's a promotion of the will over divinity. So the strictest of the Orthodox tradition, the Hesychasts, the old ritualists, Skeet dwellers, the Irish Chaldees, northern hermits of Russia, many others, stood for local control, communalism, and the worship of the tiny community or Skeet. Centralization means mechanization, bureaucratization, the rule of law, rather than the spirit of the law. The rule of law is the rule of man, and hence that of money. Now you transfer this to the Old Testament. Bernhard Anderson writes that the Israelite way of life prior to Solomon, and I'm quoting him directly here, the 12 tribes were bound together not by a centralized government, but by a common devotion to Yahweh, the God of the covenant, and by common religious and legal responsibilities. The Confederacy, by its very nature, encouraged a high degree of tribal independence. God alone was the ruler of Israelite tribes. I may be the only one, or at least the first one, to connect this to the Rechabites. You had smaller sects in the desert revolting against Solomon, later praised by the prophets and church fathers, and the Rechabites were the most important. They were opponents of the syncretism of the house of Ahab in Jeremiah chapter 35. They had a desert skeet, the wilderness ideal. Rechabites were a reaction to Canaanite civilization and its obsession with honors, centralization, technology, leading, of course, to human sacrifice to Baal, or the various Baals, in exchange for worldly success. The Rechabites were strictly Yahwist, but little in terms of ornamentation. They wouldn't drink alcohol. They associated it with decadence, the worship of wealth, power, and the leisure that wealth afforded. They connected civilization in the bad sense with all the vices of the covenant communion, of which we are the only descendant. The Rechabites were mentioned by St. John Chrysostom in his Epistle 52 very favorably. Most of the fathers did mention them favorably. In fact, he said that when the Jews were stoning the apostles, James in particular, the Rechabites who still existed, tried to intervene and stop the execution. The Rechabite, in my mind, is the Skeet ideal. It's a decentralized, essentially the desert ideal. We are to imitate this. It's a reaction to centralization, to civilization in the bad sense, in the urbanite sense. These things create classes. Broken men, bureaucracy. They create this parasitic element. Bankers, lawyers, etc., who manipulate a culture for their own ends. The church that Christ founded was not some institution in the sense of administration. I mean, after all, what was the first synodal act of all time? Hide for fear of the Jews. The fact that Christ, when he was calling out from the cross, it was said that he was calling out for Elijah. That's how close Christ was to the prophets, at least in the public mind at the time. The prophetic element is at war with the institutional element. If you remember my talk on the fools for Christ's sake, it's very similar, although an extreme manifestation. Institutions become a part of the society in which they function, and if they're to continue, they have to compromise with it. That's why prophets come into existence. The Rechabites were the prophetic answer to Israelite institutions. In 1 Chronicles, they're descended from the Kenites of Hamath, but I think they're derived from Jethro, Moses' father-in-law. But their lack of alcohol drinking, that was just a derivative practice. There were those exiles from Egypt who rejected institutions. They wouldn't have fixed buildings. They lived in tents. They refused to have anything to do with the census, anything that the state would regulate. They were called men of God because they were universally respected by the Israelites. But the Israelites couldn't leave their possessions behind, and so they never really imitated them. They were called men of God, which means that's kind of the Old Testament way that this person was very highly thought of by everyone, and their spiritual standing was not questioned. Yes, they were an extreme faction, but they were accepted as more than legitimate by the Israelites, and of course later, right up into the patristic period. What standing, other than Isaiah, what standing did the prophets have? They came out of nowhere. They were nobody. They used the harshest possible language, very much like the fools for Christ's sake did. Whore and adulterer, which were the worst things, terms you could use at the time. Christ added the den of vipers and thieves to the vocabulary. That would be us, you know, I can't repeat those words here, but that's essentially what they are. Christ was then murdered by an institution that required the ruling power in order to function. So relative to Rome, the rabbinic elite needed to pretend to be citizens, using Rome's power whenever it suited them, while, of course, plotting their demise, its demise. So the more society becomes corrupt, the more dishonest and fraudulent institutions become. In Amos chapter 3, this is what God says through the prophet. On the day I punish Israel for her sins, I will destroy the altars of Bethel. The horns of the altar will be cut off and fall to the ground. I will tear down the winter house along with the summer house. The houses adorned with ivory will be destroyed and the mansions demolished. So the two forms of houses refer to both religious shrines and the homes of the elite. I'm not talking to just the men of the time, but to us. In chapter 5, we read, "You levy a straw tax on the poor and impose a tax on their grain. Therefore, though you have built stone mansions, you will not live in them. Though you have planted lush vineyards, you will not drink their wine, for I know how many are your offenses and how great are your sins. There are those who oppress the innocent and take bribes to deprive the poor of their justice in the courts." When you deify the hierarchy, that's where the idea that sacraments are magic spells come from. Liturgies are acceptable in the Old Testament sense, only to the extent that you suffer with God. The charge of any rent is a tax, and to take biblical language with self-serving literalness, that in and of itself is a sin. A rent in the true sense, I don't mean like renting your apartment, I mean rent as non-economic extraction, simply because someone's in a position of power. This is one of the most serious sins in Scripture. The parasite is demonic. And in Amos' prophecy, Amaziah, that's it's a person representing the institutions of the Old Testament, the establishment. And he goes to Amos and he says, Israel cannot bear your words. In other words, Amos was being too judgmental. Amaziah was the Israelite priest. He represented the comfortable. After hearing what Amos had to say, he went to Jeroboam, king of Israel, and said, and he was lying, he said, the prophet Amos is conspiring against you. And that's the equivalent of the comfortable calling us terrorists or extremists or whatever, and demanding state action. Amaziah warns Amos against the latter's harsh condemnation of class rule, and even harsher condemnations of mixing with aliens. He calls Amos a damn racist, tells him to shut up. That's essentially what it was. Of course, I preach against mixing with aliens, and I'm condemned constantly. But these open letters to me are written by the ghost of Amaziah. And few of these guys even know who he was. Being pharisaical or judgmental, these are nonsensical accusations. They're Amaziah arrogantly lecturing to Amos. So the concept of centralization is pagan to its core. It requires constant human sacrifice, whether it be warfare or building of cities and dams, high taxes, the rapacious nature of the wealthy classes, who depend, in fact, on this structured existence to function. So when John Chrysostom praises the Rechabites, that's immediately connected to his contempt for the upper classes in Byzantium and the pagan system that they had erected to promote and protect their agenda. Now, what does this have to do with our initial purpose? Because these forms of corruption substitute prose for what had initially been poetry, the material for the spiritual, the institutional over the intuitive. It's very difficult to manifest a tradition in an institution, although in many cases it has to be protected. But it is very easy for the institution to overtake it, for the state to become its own master rather than being a servant. In other words, there's a connection between the ideology of Nimrod after the flood. You see this in Solomon, you see it in Tyre, the city of Tyre, that version of ecumenism, because they brought the pagan deities there. So when someone says we want orthodoxy to become a part of American life, what exactly are you talking about? Since the so-called American culture, it's an anti-culture, it comes from the regime's corporate, liberal, and fashion elite. Is that what you're talking about? Civilization demands mechanization, bureaucratization, for legality, and it serves to protect the interests of those who have the power to erect and administer this. This is an obsession, a fetish. This is a control you find in the Enlightenment idea of science, both natural and social, leading to social regimentation, bizarrely in the name of freedom and progress. The Rechabites saw what institutions were doing to the true sense of the old law. They would have been absolutely aghast at the Talmud, because the Talmud is an extreme version of what comes out of it. It's really a Solomonite, Pharisaical concept. The Rechabites saw taking the quantity out of the quality, worrying about institutionalizing the spiritual and not worrying that the institutional can destroy the spiritual. The rule of the ethno-canonical tradition, in orthodoxy, ethnicity, language, the informal, decentralized nature of the church, this is the ancient understanding. And I'm not going to say that there sometimes aren't good reasons for this, where centralization is necessary to save what couldn't be saved in the midst of warfare or whatever, especially for fairly small areas, small groups of people who are vulnerable. But that doesn't take away from the fact that Sabornost would be the poetic and spiritual side of things. Reducing canon law to the words that they use, which I think a lot of people do because it's easy, or considering prayer just like a petition to God, like you would bring a petition to the mayor to ask for something from your, you know, from your boss. This is what happens. You start deifying these institutions, whether even including synods, and there you have the removal from Sabornopravda, from Sabornos. It's a relationship between the rule of Solomon and the Rechabites, or the old Israelite law, or the old believers versus the Petrine state, which did, you know, come about partially through Alexis. I'm sorry, through Nikon and, of course, the Tsar Alexis, but found its extreme expression, its almost permanent expression, in the Petrine state. And one of the first things that that state did was go after our Orthodox version of the Rechabites, our Skeets, the decentralized, and the old believers ended up taking over. And that this is what we mean. Sabornopravda is the very opposite of the empire. It's the spirit of canon law, not merely the words, policies and procedures, as the worst possible thing to fall back on. Because it's easy. The debased mind wants to think in terms of quantities, numbers. It's easy. But the test of alienation is whether or not the custom tradition of a people is sufficient to maintain order. When it's not, you have a huge problem. Now, the state may have to take action in that case. You know, the Taliban in Afghanistan are a clear example. But the Rechabites knew what an institution can do. They stress the quantitative at the expense of the spiritual, the qualitative. But there is an ancient foundation to this. This is why I brought up the pagan Janus Prometheus, the keys to heaven and earth that only that kind of system could bring about. Remember, Spengler made a distinction between culture and civilization. Culture is our ethnic tradition, Sabornopravda, the decentralized rule of the Skeet, whatever, the clergy. The civilization is when that falls apart, where very powerful people want to use institutions to quantify that spirit, that poetry, and render it as a matter of numbers or technology, and hence destroying it. It's a distinction between the Rechabites on the one hand and the Talmudists on the other. And this goes back to the very fall of Adam. Nimrod is who took over and built the cities after the flood. And this initial group of gods that I already cited, Apollo being one, were those who laid out, especially in Prometheus being a titan, for the most part, half titan. And titans were like the titans of industry. This was the civilization being parasitic over the culture, civilization acting parasitic over the culture while destroying it, and yet demanding that its morality continue to function even after it's been destroyed. The concept of grace as an uncreated entity that everyone has access to so long as they're truly Orthodox, versus grace as a created matter that only a clergyman or a synod can create, when I say the papacy, and then dispense it. These are opposite things. It's a consistent decay from the ancient Israelite law all the way to the uber centralization civilizational structures of Solomon based on the monetized economy, usury, and everything else. All of these things tend to go together. This is why paganism was seen as an evil. And it's manifest all the time. And this was one of the great arguments of the Slavophiles and their great contribution to the Orthodox world, is showing this distinction. Spirit of the law versus the letter of the law. What are those two things? How do they tease themselves out? Where does each one lead to? All this talk about civilization is where the letter of the law leads. The old believers is where the spirit of the law leads. This is the very foundation of Orthodoxy. This is the very foundation of everything we are and what we do. Thank you, everyone, for listening. As always, I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.